Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
It's Wednesday, October 12, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Our dynamic duo of panelists is here as well, School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. We'll share our analysis and opinions this week on three topics involving the media and free expression. The University of Missouri may need to revise a proposed policy that would have banned classroom recordings without a professor's consent. Some question whether the policy was more about protecting the university from embarrassment than protecting students' free expression rights. Apple founder Steve Jobs' passing last week after a long battle with pancreatic cancer had most media in full fanboy mode. Did the tech titan deserve such lengthy and positive coverage? And why did one writer feel the need to point out that, quote, Steve Jobs is not God? And a statistical analysis shows the number of lengthy stories in the Wall Street Journal has plunged since Rupert Murdoch took over 4 years ago. Is one of the country's top newspapers shortchanging its readers, or is it bypassing self-indulgent pieces in favor of stories that its business-centric audience wants and needs? Well, let's start off with the local story, and this involves, and perhaps a little background is appropriate at this point, a University of Missouri policy that was proposed, written by the legal counsel, vetted by faculty council, brought up by the faculty governing body earlier this past week, to talk about whether or not it should be appropriate for anyone, including students, to record content in a classroom, discussions, debate, whatever is said in the classroom, without the faculty member's consent. This whole thing stems from an event last spring where a student in a labor class at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which was being broadcast or video cast back to the campus in St. Louis, where a student took the video of a discussion about violence in the labor movement and gave it to Andrew Breitbart, the conservative blogger media person, and it was used by the conservative blogosphere to show that those darn liberal professors are talking up communism and labor violence in their classroom with all of these innocent students. Well, after all the fallout about that, the university decided the best way to deal with those kinds of embarrassments was to propose a policy saying, unless the faculty member says it's okay to record what's going on in the classroom, you can't do it. If you do do it, whether you're a student, a staff member, a faculty member, you can be penalized for doing so. That's as much background as I'm going to give at the moment. We'll probably get a little bit more of it as we do the discussion. But quite a few of us in the journalism school felt that this was an inappropriate solution to what might not be that big a problem. Charles, and I wonder if you also felt that the notion of protecting students from themselves, so to speak, was enough of a rationale for saying no recording in the classroom unless a faculty member says so.
Now, it's incredibly disingenuous. I think that the policy was directed at protecting faculty from themselves, not protecting students. And in fact, it has nothing to do with protecting students. The students in these cases are the tapers. They're wanting to capture on iPhone or small video recorder their professors for whatever reason. Right. I teach in a large lecture setting, and I typically have several people probably videotaping me unbeknownst to me. Sometimes I know. Not too long ago, I had an international visitor taping, and I said, you know, why are you taping? Not that I really care. And she said, because I don't understand you. You talk really quickly and you use a lot of slang. And I said, guilty as charged. And so I think if it helps her comprehension, then I'm all for it. What I think ultimately at the root of this, though, is that it's a solution looking for a problem. The problem was this isolated, spectacular case, which may happen again in the annals of American history, may not. And as a result of that, we enact a policy that applies to every case in every classroom every day. And it just seems like regulatory overkill.
Well, Lee, I use that very same phrase in the media, a solution in search of a problem. So obviously I agree with Charles in the big picture. But there were faculty members and university administrators who, with a straight face, and I assume that they believe this, at least to a certain extent, were saying that students need a safe environment to discuss controversial issues. And knowing that something could be taped and that their images and their opinions could be edited in some false light and then put out on the internet for all to see was not a safe environment. Is that not a legitimate argument or concern?
I think it's a very legitimate argument or concern, but it's not just about what happens in the classroom. You could have this same problem in the local bar. The problem is you'd probably be drunk and the tape would be even worse. But, you know, the notion that Person A, Charles Davis, because he teaches a big lecture class and he's well-known on campus, we're going to tape him and edit him in a certain way. I agree with Charles. It's disingenuous. It's about protecting faculty. It's not about protecting students. And the way that you give students a safe environment is actually, this is a place where I agree with Charles. It's more speech. It's more open speech. It's by telling students that on these difficult, prickly, emotional subjects. In my ethics class, we do a segment on hate speech every semester. And there are a few semesters where somebody at some point has not been in tears because of the nature of the material. That needs to be a safe place. And students need to know that they have your permission and the permission of their colleagues in the class to say what they think and to feel what they feel, and then to be able to discuss those things in a somewhat calmer, somewhat more rational manner, depending on what it is.
Yeah, I see that, Charles, but I also wonder if sometimes we're underlining that word safe to the detriment of everything else. I mean, really, in a college classroom, I don't think it's just about saying you should have opinions or we should hide behind our opinions in some safe manner. We should be robustly debating our opinion. Isn't that what we're trying to teach?
I'm going to take exception with the very mention of the word safe. These are adults. These are not sixth graders. I think our discourse in classrooms should sometimes be unsafe. They should rattle cages and rattle brains and challenge stereotypes and attack preconceived notions. And none of those things are safe.
But
they're fairly radical.
I think the safe part is you can attack preconceived notions so long as I don't attack Charles, the human being.
Sure.
And students need to learn how to do that, because if you look at our current political discourse, it's not a skill that's on constant display.
But wouldn't you agree that one way to make that environment safe is to actually document what occurs? I'm more worried about a faculty member or other students putting down someone else's opinion because they don't agree with it and no one's capturing it. If I can't record what's happening in class, if I can't tweet about what's happening in class, if I can't blog about what's happening in class, I can't share notes about what's happening in class, that makes me feel more unsafe if my opinions diverge from what's popular.
Yeah, and what's tough about that, I think something we haven't talked about, and this is probably some of the university's thinking, not faculty council, but university council, is the commercial angle. The fact that eventually some smart kid's going to figure out that you could do something with taping lectures and, you know, form something called I don't want to go to class.com or something, and you would have past lectures, or I don't know, you would do something to commercialize that content. And that is another headache altogether.
When I was talking to other faculty colleagues about this, that actually was the thing that they were more concerned about. You know, now I'm making all of this up, is my department chair going to come in and tape my American government lectures, which deal with controversial topics, upload those to the web, charge tuition, okay, give credit for the course, and all the while I'm out my intellectual property.
See, I think that is a legitimate argument, but it's not one that was being advanced in these discussions. I mean, there's lots of material that's already podcast in many classes on the university campus today. There are lots of faculty members who've put a lot of effort into the presentations they show in class. And I should have some protection that my intellectual property is not being used against my will or without any kind of, you know, reimbursement for me. But that's really not what this argument was about. And the perception, it seems to me, is even worse, Charles, is Clyde Bentley, one of our colleagues who's on faculty council, pointed out there. He said the public perception when they read about this kind of policy might very well be, what are the faculty trying to hide from the taxpayers?
Right. Oh, I think from a public relations standpoint, it's a debacle. because it looks like, oh, protect us, the college professor elites who already have a fair bit of protection called academic freedom, right? That's what we're ultimately not talking about here. Those professors had every right to say whatever they said in whatever context they said it. That is an undeniable, unassailable fact. The idea that Breitbart or any of his cronies would attack that is an attack on academic freedom and should be recognized as such. And the pushback should be more discourse, better discourse, louder discourse. I don't care if it's louder, but more.
Well, so before we leave this topic, let's go to what really generated it in the first place. As we said, when Andrew Breitbart's websites published the video, as it turned out after some examination, highly edited video, again, of two professors, one actually an adjunct who's a labor leader in St. Louis, and another professor who directs a labor studies center at UMKC. And they have a video conference going on, and you can see in the edited version that they seem to be saying that violence by labor because of their history is okay and even appropriate at times, that intimidation is okay at times in order to get what you want. It was highly edited, Lee, but there's no question that there also were some interesting comments that were being made by the professors and the students in that class.
I think, yes, there were. And I want to go back to something that Charles said, because I agree that academic freedom is very important. It is not unassailable. There are times in American history where it absolutely has been assailed. And that's another thing that sort of doesn't get talked about here, but that I really want to guard against. I was a reporter in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I came from Colorado. There aren't many unions in Colorado, so one of the things I did when I moved to Michigan is I had to learn a little labor history. I didn't know until I lived in Michigan that members of the United Auto Workers had died to form that union. To teach a class on labor relations and not bring those sorts of historic facts, and they are facts, how you want to interpret them is something else, but not bring those historic facts up to this generation of students, I think is shortchanging them intellectually.
Charles, I know that we're sympathetic to the fact that Breitbart and others like him, O'Keefe, have done some pretty creative editing of these sorts of video exposés in the past, but I also wonder why the university, if it's worried about that, saying the video is unedited, why don't they release all of the 18 hours or whatever of lectures that are videotaped?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I would drown them in context. They want context, they would have it up to their eyeballs. But I think it's such an important point, I think, that Lee makes, which is all of this context and what did they say and what was edited out and what wasn't edited out. It's almost like the whole, you know, teach the controversy thing. It distracts you from what fundamentally is an assault on academic freedom. Fundamentally. Yeah. And you can dress Breitbart up 1,000 different ways, and you can talk about context until you're blue in the face. These people want to go around and videotape faculty making statements that they then can use against them.
Yeah, that's
simple
true.
As that.
One other point, and maybe it's a small one, but to me at least it was interestingly, I looked at all of the media coverage of this story locally, the Missourian and the Tribune and KOMU and the Maneater, all these various publications covered the story fairly well, but I noticed one common thing missing from every single one, including the Maneater. Not a single student was quoted in any of these stories.
And I think if you're going to say in your policy, as this policy says, this is all about students, you maybe should go talk to students. I know that's a radical kind of a thing to say. The other thing I've learned from talking about this with folks on other campuses is that this is a place where we journalism folks are just a little bit thicker skinned than many of our faculty colleagues. We kind of know we're on display, and we've had careers where we're on display. For some of our faculty colleagues, the notion that somebody would tape them and make it available to a wider audience is very frightening. And I don't mean that in a malevolent sense. It's just so unusual.
Well, talking about being on public display, as surely everyone in the world knows by now, Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple and the inspiration from the iMac, the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, died last Wednesday at his home at the age of 56. And the announcement came late in the afternoon. The tweeting, the blogging, all the traditional media reporting that followed soon after was, I think we could all agree, for the most part, deeply laudatory. For example, the Wall Street Journal's Walter Mossberg, who was kind of a friend of Jobs as well as covering him, said he was a historical figure on the scale of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. Another journalist I saw in Great Britain compared him to Leonardo da Vinci. On Thursday, Good Morning America gave its first 15 minutes over to Jobs' passing, with George Stephanopoulos and Robin Roberts almost breathless in their introduction.
He created such a personal connection between the people and the product. You see it outside. Everybody's got their iPhones outside this morning. And it's also so fitting that the tributes are rocketing around the virtual world that he inspired on YouTube. So many fans flooded onto Twitter that it went down right after the news broke. And the powerful remembering him, too, including President Obama. Steve Jobs gave him his own iPad, and he said that Steve was among the greatest of American innovators, brave enough to think differently, bold enough to believe he could change the world, and talented enough to do it.
And I told you when I was flying back from Knoxville last night, turned on our phones when we landed, and you could hear this gasp throughout the plane as people were turning on their iPhones and learning the news.
And that was happening everywhere.
Yeah. And you're looking at Apple's headquarters right now in California, and from there to all around the world, it has been a sudden and spontaneous outpouring of emotion and support and just plain old love.
Even in death, Steve Jobs getting plenty of marketing for his company in there on Good Morning America. Now, granted, he was, by many people's estimation, a great business person who had a huge impact on technology. All the special programs, though, and the special magazine editions and all of the sort of laudatory, the stories we had about him in the days that followed, did he, Charles, deserve that much positive attention?
Well, yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, it would have been nice to have some critique, a little bit of, at least a recognition of the irony of here's a guy who built a consumer church around the notion of being a rebel, being an outsider, smashing the orthodoxy. I go back to that 1984 commercial that may be the greatest television commercial in history. The whole concept of it is a lie when you peel it away, which is you be the outsider, you be the rebel. Buy our product, and it's worked so magnificently. And I would have liked to have seen at least some, but maybe his death was not the moment to do that, right?
I wonder, too, I agree with that, but I wonder, too, Lee, whether or not journalists were sort of the early adopters. They liked the underdog story. They liked the products. They kind of liked, I think, being manipulated by Jobs with all of his announcements. I mean, they're really, if there was ever this fanboy culture, I think that journalists fell into it.
Well, you want to dance with somebody who knows the moves. And I think he did journalistically in many ways. I also have to say that I learned some things from some of the coverage, and I want to talk about one of the things, Mike, that you posted on the blog. I didn't know, because I haven't read that much about Jobs, the human being, that from a very early age, he had this vision of wanting to change the world. You don't find people like that very often. And in that sense, the comments about, I want to change the world, like Thomas Edison, like Henry Ford, I think that's a very legitimate parallel to draw. I don't find that hyperbolic. I don't find that exaggerated. Greatest thing since Leonardo DiCaprio, maybe, not Da Vinci. Da Vinci drew, Steve Jobs did not. I was really irritated with some of the discussion that focused on, well, we never had pictures of his family, and we didn't know very much about his disease. For crying out loud, folks, his family's private, and his disease was his business, in the sense that it was reported on enough that those of us who own Apple stock, that would be everybody sitting here who participates in the university retirement plan, I actually did go look that one up, knows that there's a financial impact here because of his unique kind of leadership of Apple. That's all I needed to know about his cancer. The rest of it was none of my business. And I'm really irritated at the journalists who said it was bad coverage because we didn't know all of this stuff. Poo on them.
I wonder, Charles, if you think there's anything to this notion that there's sort of a generational difference in the reaction to Jobs' death, too, because, you know, a lot of people sort of our age will point out the warts, will talk about the fact that, yeah, they invented great things, but they were, you know, consumer products. They were, some people even called them toys. I wouldn't say that. But our students and people of that generation seem to treat Jobs almost as a hero. When I brought it up in class, for example, there was very little criticism and a lot of people who thought he's had an enormous impact on their lives.
Yeah, well, you know, there's an industrial term, tech transfer, about the idea that technologies move from society to society. I think in this instance, we had tech transfer from a human being to a device. I think the generational shift that you see is the fact that for us, Steve Jobs was a man. For a 19-year-old, Steve Jobs is an iPhone. He literally became the devices that he marketed. Yeah. Not literally, okay, but from a symbolic standpoint. And I think that's why the mourning you saw was so intergenerational. I mean, you saw 20-year-olds deeply moved about the death of a 50-year-old. And that's because to them, he wasn't a 50-year-old. He was a six-month-old iPad or a two-year-old iPhone.
Well, when you talk about that kind of transfiguration, it leads me to one criticism I thought that was very interesting of Steve Jobs from a blogger over at Gawker. His name is Hamilton Nolan, and the headline of his story was, "Steve Jobs was not God." And Lee, here's what I think was the nut of his story. "He did not meaningfully reduce poverty or make life-saving scientific discoveries or end wars or heal the sick or befriend the friendless, which is fine, most of us don't, but most of us don't provoke such cult-like lachrymosity when we pass on. Some perspective has been lost."
He had a lot of fun writing that last sentence. There's not often you see lachrymose used in journalism. I would point out as a little bit of a counter that no, he didn't do anything about poverty or all of that. His devices in some way were responsible or were central to Arab Spring. His devices in some way are central to the protests going on about Wall Street. He hasn't ended poverty. He's made my life as a person both harder and easier. He's made me a better teacher. He's made me a more frustrated teacher because I'm not so tech savvy. So the notion that he didn't do any of these things, I'm sorry, to me, that's a little bit of hyperbole in the other direction, despite the fact that I really like lachrymose a lot.
And Charles, I do think that he had, regardless of what impact he's had on the world, he's had a huge impact on the media and how we're going to move forward, if we do, in trying to maintain and grow audiences.
Absolutely. And I think in an even broader sense, there are emerging democracies around the world, Arab Spring, but also across Central Europe, where people are riding the rails of the product ecosystem he's developed that will down the road fuel democratic societies, literally. And that's big stuff.
Well, there was a little mini controversy that emerged in some of the media coverage of Steve Jobs' passing this past week when the New Yorker magazine on its cover ran a cartoon of Steve Jobs at the pearly gates of heaven. And here is St. Peter with an iPad going through the list to see whether Jobs deserves to go into heaven. And there were some people, and I'm sure that they were being sincere in their criticism. Steve Jobs was an acknowledged Buddhist for much of his life. Why are we showing him, you know, at the pearly gates with St. Peter? Is this just one step too far in the criticism?
I think it maybe shows a little bit of a lack of imagination on our part, although my understanding of Buddhism is that you do try to come back as your better self. So, you know, in that sense, in the giant metaphor sense of the term, it makes a difference. I actually like the cartoon that ran in the Tribune where he's meeting, I don't think it's necessarily St. Peter, it may be just an angel who's playing a harp, and he takes the harp and goes, "Well, this device hasn't been updated in a while." And there was a little bit of tenderness about that I thought in some ways was indeed very Buddhist.
And in fact, we have a link to Kegel Cartoons, and they have a whole collection of dozens of cartoons that were drawn about Steve Jobs. And if you'd like to see those, they're on the blog. One last story before we wrap it up this week. And this involves a little bit of scientific analysis, if you will, that Ryan Chittum at the Columbia Journalism Review did this past week, looking at the Wall Street Journal. A lot of people, for various reasons, have complained that since that Rupert Murdoch took over the Wall Street Journal, that there has been less of a sort of serious, long-form journalism, more USA Today-like bits and bytes of journalism. And so Chittum decided to put it to the test. He used some tools online to measure how many stories of 1,500 words or more had appeared in the Wall Street Journal going back a few years and then through the Murdoch years. And what he found was that just before Murdoch took over the paper in 2006, the journal had run a high of almost 800 of these long, in-depth think pieces on the front page of the journal. This year, and he had to use a little bit of extrapolation since the year's not over yet, it'll be less than 300. And then he goes on to argue that this is doing a disservice to their readers, that we need this kind of long-form reportage to explore issues in more detail. Some other people don't think that's necessarily a problem, that the journal has been successful financially where other papers have not in the current environment, Charles, because they serve the audience that reads their paper that wants shorter, more targeted business coverage.
As a guy who used to write long-form stories, not very well, but I used to write them and I sure enjoyed it. I found it to be a complete ego stroke to write a 3,000-word story and get it in the newspaper. I remember we used to have Sunday editions we called poodle killers because they weighed about 12 pounds, and if the newspaper guy hit them, it would kill your poodle. That was an exercise in vain self-glory, frankly. Rarely did many of those stories justify the inches that they took up in column space. I think nothing has changed, except journalistic egos may have gotten even larger. So I got to say I'm swimming with Rupert on this one. I think that there's probably much to be said about shorter stories unless something truly is compelling enough to merit long form. And in my history, I've read a lot of stories. New York Times is a fine example. I've read a lot of stories in the New York Times where I'm in about column inch 60 going, why is the story still going?
Lee, would you share that assessment?
I'm still struck on the poodle killer thing. I would and I wouldn't. Charles, I agree. Everybody needs an editor, and everybody most certainly includes me. But I teach with Janet Saidi, the news director at KBIA, a class in what the students call aspirational journalism, where the stories that we're presenting them are almost all longer than 2,500 words. And what they tell us week after week was, I didn't know journalism could be like this. I didn't know journalism could paint these kind of subtle, nuanced pictures. And we're not doing this just with stories. We're doing it with long-form audio docs and occasionally some long-form film. My point being, the financial crisis was complicated and complex. It was Byzantine. What better news organization to explain it to all of us, not just the highly niched financial reader, than the Wall Street Journal? What a terrible time to make your stories shorter, when in fact I would argue that this is a place where you've got whole books that actually aren't uncovering much of this as we really needed to know.
I can agree with that, but also say that I don't think that necessarily there has to be some artificial number of one or two front page, in-depth, 2,000-word stories every day in the paper to meet that objective. And I also wonder why the analysis is done only of the Wall Street Journal, not of other papers like the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times or others, where I'm sure the level of in-depth storytelling has gone down with the economic pressures that the newspaper business has been involved with lately. But that's where we're going to have to leave it for this week. Thanks for listening or watching. If you'd like to ask a question, you can send a topic suggestion or even offer an opinion on our opinions by emailing us at views@kbia.org. You can also visit our blog, kbiaviews.blogspot.com. That's where you'll find links to articles, photos, video, and audio that are related to our topics. Our production team this week is Travis McMillan with the Reynolds Journalism Institute, Pat Akers with KBIA, and student assistant Ryan Williams. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Lee Wilkins, Charles Davis, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.